What is happening, gang? We have got a jam-packed show for you today on the Inside Football Podcast with Bill Polian. Bills Mafia, you have been calling for it, and we are here to answer the bell. You might be 4-0 in this season, but we are going to take you back to a tumultuous time in Bills history in 1984 and 1985 as Bill would descend upon Buffalo and begin the process of building one of the great dynasties in NFL history. This is our first look at building the Buffalo Bills. In this first episode, we look at Bill and his early days with the Bills, from moving on from the USFL to some of the first key things he had to navigate, the biggest of which is getting Bruce Smith signed at the top of the 1985 NFL draft. This is truly an awesome episode. Even if you're not a super Bills fan, this was one of the most sort of interesting times in the league. You had the end of the USFL, you were competing for players, the 85 draft was a mega draft, the Bills would end up taking two Hall of Fame players in Bruce Smith and Andre Reed, and had a chance to get Jerry Rice, which I ask about in the show. So sit back, relax, and get ready. This is the Inside Football Podcast with Bill Polian, and this is our look at building the Bills. All right. Well, hey, speaking of lighting things on fire, Bills Mafia, get the tables ready, fire them up, and get ready to set them on fire, because you guys have asked for it, and we have it. Today, we begin our three-part look at building the Bills. This has been something you guys have been clamoring for weeks, and so we cannot wait on the heels of another Bills victory yesterday in Las Vegas to dive into these embryonic days with the Buffalo Bills. So without any further ado, Rick, kick us into the story for this week that I believe starts in the 1984 range.
That would be exactly right. I think that is the place to start. You got to remember, especially for our younger listeners, that pro football was a really different place then. You had a competitive league, the USFL, which was at first a spring league, but was looking to actually go head-to-head with the NFL. But the big thing was they were paying big money, kind of like the days when you back to the AFL-NFL rivalry. Bill, at this point in time, 1984, was serving as the de facto GM of a team called the Chicago Blitz. Bill, tell us about your USFL experience in general and the Blitz in specific.
Well, the Blitz was in effect an expansion team. There had been a Chicago Blitz the previous year, the first year of the USFL, that was coached by George Allen. But the owner of that team, who was a Phoenix heart surgeon, decided to move the team to Phoenix, and they became the Arizona Wranglers. And what was left of the Chicago Blitz was a headquarters at Maine North High School outside Chicago, some front office staffers, no coach, no football people, very few players, and as it turned out, very little equipment. So Coach Levy was hired to be the head coach and general manager, and I was then the personnel director and assistant GM of the Winnipeg Blue Bombers in the CFL. So Coach Levy offered me the job. Naturally, I jumped at it. And little did both of us know that we were inheriting what amounted to a skeleton, skeleton force and skeleton everything else. So one of the few people who stayed behind because he was a Illinois native was John Butler. So he became the personnel director. I became the essentially the assistant GM, and we hired a coaching staff, and we had some players left over who the Wranglers chose not to sign for the following year. They were largely old bears. Revy Sorry, people like that, Vince Evans, our quarterback. But we had to build the team basically from scratch. So John Butler and I holed up in a hotel room in the Skokie, Illinois Hilton for 3 weeks. We went home for Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, came back, spent New Year's Eve in there building a roster through signings and people that we were going to draft in the college draft and people we could cull from other teams' cuts, et cetera. And we both smoked heavily in those days. And I'm sure that the room has never, you know, never lost the smell of that smoke.
Hey, Bill, please tell me you at least smoke filters.
Yeah, they were filters, both of us.
Okay, not Camels. Okay, good. Okay.
But the in any event, we went off to camp in Arizona, and we had a remarkably functional camp. That's Coach Levy, of course. Nothing bothers him. He just, you know, take one step at a time and keep your eye on the target. We had a wonderful training camp at a high school that was defunct, you know, wasn't operating in the Tempe area, and everything was running along smoothly. And I got a call during practice one day from our executive assistant, Debbie Pollum, who said, "You need to come over here right away. Steve Earhart from the league office wants to meet with you." So I went over to the headquarters, which was in the hotel we were staying in, and Steve sat down and said, "The doctor," and I, to be honest with you, I forget his name right now. He was from Milwaukee. He was also a heart surgeon who had bought the team from essentially Dr. Dietrich and George Allen, has walked away. So you are now a ward of the league, and your budget is cut by 50%. So we, with that good news, we could, Marv just said, okay, let's keep going. You know, that's all let's just keep on going. What else can we do? So we did. And, the league sent in a guy named Carl Marasco, who was one of the original draft Knicks, to sort of oversee, what was going on and report back to the league. But he thought he was going to be the general manager, and he traded our best receiver while we were at a road game in Detroit. when we got back, I was apoplectic, and it took about two good – took John Butler's, it was about 6'5 and 325 pounds, and it took all of his strength to keep me from – doing harm to Marasco. but we talked with the commissioner of the league, Chet Simmons, and made it clear to him that we weren't going to turn over the football operation to his designee. And Steve Earhart, who's now, by the way, runs the Liberty Bowl, the bowl game and the group that sponsors it, was very good, and you know, made it clear to Marasco, you're here to just make sure that money isn't wasted and stuff like that. You're not, don't let the football guys run football. So anyway, we lost six straight to start the season, and then made a lot of changes on the roster and ended up winning five straight at the end. Losing on the last day, we would have made the playoffs to the New York, the New Jersey Generals, and on a terrible call at the end of the game, which I've never forgotten. I won't mention the name of the official, but he later went on to officiate in the NFL, and I would always remind him of it.
Did he ever give you payback in the NFL?
You know what? He's such a nice guy. He I can't, not that I can remember. We never really had any trouble with him in the NFL, but he's such a nice guy. He would always, he said, "You're never going to forgive me, are you?" I said, "No, I'm not."
You can't make those things up. That doesn't work.
Yeah.
No. In any event, our season ended on an upbeat note, albeit a funny one. As part of the protocol, it's up to the home team to supply towels for the visiting team. And that game against the New Jersey Generals, I believe, was our last game of the season. And we did not have towels to supply to them. at that time, there was a Holiday Inn very near Soldier Field, old Soldier Field, not the building that's been renovated now, and right near McCormick Place, which is adjacent to Soldier Field, which is the big convention center. So I literally took about 25 jerseys, game jerseys that were we weren't going to wear that day. They were road jerseys. And Vince Evans and a few others, Doug Plank, et cetera, former Bears, had them autographed, and I traded them for, I think, 250 towels on the day before the game.
That's got to be a football first when you do the signed jersey for towels trade. I don't think that's happening next weekend.
That would also say something about the use of that jerseys are equal to each one jersey is a towel.
Yeah,
but had it not been signed, probably not equal to a towel.
You know, one jersey equaled about 20 towels.
All right, but unsigned, it would have been like washcloths.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you get washcloths. But I blame Rick for all of this, because if Rick hadn't landed Herschel Walker with the New Jersey Generals, you probably would have won and, you know, been in the playoffs, right?
Well, I'll leave that up to you, Bill.
As I recall, Herschel had one touchdown that day. I can't remember what. I don't think he did much else other than that. In any event.
Again, Rick's fault.
The league then went dark at the behest of Donald Trump, who was they were suing the NFL, and they were going to go dark and begin play in the fall 2 years later. So at that point, Eddie Einhorn, as the principal owner, and Jerry Reinsdorf, both of whom owned the Chicago White Sox, came in and bought the Blitz. And it was soon after July 4th. I went downtown, met with them, along with a man named Gene Fanning, one of the most wonderful and honorable people I've ever met in my life. He's deceased now, God rest his soul. So is Eddie. And they offered me the GM's job formally, which I accepted. And then less than 2 weeks later, I got a call from Don Lawrence, who was then the defensive coordinator of the Buffalo Bills, who I'd worked with the Kansas City Chiefs. And he said, we have an opening here for a personnel director, and a pro personnel director. We've never had one before. The guy that had the job, we just hired him. He's had a horrible back issue and can't work, and we got to fill the position. So I recommended you to Kay Stevenson, who's the head coach. Could you hop over here and interview? So I said, sure, I'd be happy to. So I told Marv. He said, go ahead on the interview. That's fine. And I told Gene Fanning, to whom I reported on a day-by-day basis. And both of them said to me, look, you know, that's a subordinate position. You're going to be the GM here. You're going to be the guy calling the shots. And if this league goes, your career will skyrocket. And I liked very much living in Chicago. It's one of the most wonderful places to live in the world. And especially a good sports city. In any event, I went and had the interview. Kay called me the next day and essentially offered me the job. He said, I want you to meet with Terry Bledsoe, the general manager, but that's just a formality. I'm making the hire. And it was about, as I recall, it was $20,000 less than I was making with the Blitz. My wife claims that it was $30,000 less. she's probably right.
But you might have gotten towels.
But I could have all the towels I wanted. There was exactly. No, I mean, right. that was the essence of it.
That's the key.
Exactly. Unlimited towels.
We were going to play football, and we had unlimited towels and socks and T-shirts and what have you. And, of course, it was the NFL. So I went and spoke to Marv and to and not to Gene immediately. Marv tried to dissuade me, and I was really torn about it. And then there was a league meeting where Donald Trump announced formally that we were going to go dark and that we were going to sue the NFL and the USFL was going to win and so on and so forth. And I had to go see Gene Fanning, and I sat down and I explained everything to Gene, and I said, I'm really worried about this idea of going dark, Gene. He was in the automotive business, by the way, very successfully. And I said, you know, if you closed up your showroom for a year and then reopened, then your clientele is going to go elsewhere. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me. He also, Gene Fanning, was also an adjunct professor at the Notre Dame Business School, Notre Dame graduate. And he said to me, look, I'm not sure I should tell you this, but he said, you got a big family. Take care of your family first. We're going to hate to lose you, but I can't say that the future of this league is as good as that of the NFL, that's for sure. And I never forgot his generosity because I thought so highly of him. If he had said to me, Bill, stay, we're going to make this work, I probably would have. But he said what he said, and I told Marv that I had to go. And Marv was, of course, as always, gracious. And John Butler stepped into my shoes, which was a good thing. John was perfectly capable, as he later proved during his time as general manager in both Buffalo and San Diego. And so off I went to the Buffalo Bills. But 84 was kind of a crazy year in the sense that the person who had preceded me briefly had never set the office up. So there was a small office with no boards and no personnel boards in it, nothing but old newspapers stacked up in the corner. So I had to get rid of that. It was the size of maybe a large broom closet. You know, it wasn't very big. It was tucked in between the coach's conference room and the quarterback room. I got to work and just worked night and day to try to get everything squared away and set up and running before we went to training camp. And then we went to camp and things were hectic. And when we got back from camp, I drove back with Coach Stevenson and he said to me, hey, by the way, if Mr. Wilson hasn't been around, the owner. So he said, and you're going to be out doing the advance work on Thursday through Sunday anyway, so you're not likely to see him. But if you do, lay low, you know, go in your office and hide or something, because he doesn't know we filled the job.
Just hide under the newspapers.
So welcome to the glamour of the NFL. You're working out of a broom closet, and you got to hide when the boss shows up. But I don't want to leave one thing out of the story. In addition to your player personnel, pro personnel duties, you also had some coaching duties. And there's a good Jim Ringo story that goes with this. Would you tell us about your coaching stint and Mr. Ringo?
Well, the coaching I did was really helping out with special teams. But the Jim Ringo story is priceless because it's as true a portrait of Jim Ringo as anyone will ever hear. Jim was a legendary Hall of Fame center for Vince Lombardi in Green Bay. And, you know, he claims he played at 215. I think that's probably about right. He was by far the toughest physically and mentally person I'd ever met. And Ringo was an apt name because if he played in a Western as the monosyllabic, stern, concrete-like Sheriff Ringo, that's what you saw. That's what he was. That was his personality.
Johnny Ringo.
Yeah. We were out to dinner one night with the whole staff, and I was seated about three seats from him at this big round table, and he was next to Kay Stevenson, and he said to Kay, "Who's that down there?" Pointed toward me. And Kay said, "That's Bill Polian." He said, "He's our pro guy. He's terrific. He helps us win." And Jim said, he grumbled. So the next day I came to work and he walked into my office and, "No, hello, how are you?" Nothing like that. He said, "I want a complete rundown on all the rush fronts in the division." In those days, that was a six-team division, the AFC East. Miami was king of the hill. And Jim was the offensive line coach. So, you know, how do you do this quickly? He said, "I want it by Thursday." This was Saturday. So I said to my wife, "I'll see you, you know, sometime after Thursday." This was the off season. And I got in the office and went to work, went over the film, went over the old scouting reports, wrote it up, worked literally night and day. And so walked in to Jim's office on Thursday morning. I said, "Coach, here's the rundown you wanted." So he looked up and he said, "Okay." And out I walked. So now keep in mind that this is Vince Lombardi's Hall of Fame center, right? So for someone like me who's trying to make his way in professional football, this might be like meeting General MacArthur, you know?
Right.
It's just right? And if he's just so much as says get lost, that's the end of your career, right?
Right. You're just independently getting lost on your own at that point.
Exactly right, yeah. So a day goes by. The following afternoon, he walks into my office, takes the scouting report, which I don't know, 50, 75 pages, and tosses it on my desk and says, "You'll do." So, and from that day forward, we were close friends.
See, I think that should have been in the name of the running for the book. I think you'll do much stronger than the game plan.
Yeah.
Yeah. Come to think of it, you might have been right.
Pretty good.
Yeah, it's clearly better than "you won't do," but all right.
Right.
So we're going on to Silver Linings playbook time here. So that season, and it was not Bill's fault, the Bills wound up 2-14, worst in the league. But that earned you the first draft pick in the 85 draft. But before we get to that pick in the regular draft, there was a complex scenario that played out that included Bernie Kosar, our good buddy Ernie Accorsi, the supplemental draft, Chip Banks, and a valuable insider tip and a contingency plan that played off big time. Tell us about that, Bill.
Well, the first order of business was the regular draft, because at 2-14, we had the first pick in the draft. And the question was were we going to take Bruce Smith, or were we going to take the Texas A&M defensive tackle, whose name escapes me at the moment? It shouldn't, but
Ray Childress. This is one of my favorite drafts of all time, by the way. So I dorkily know it very well.
So, Norm Pollum and Kay made that call, and I had a voice in it. Interestingly enough, I was pretty close. I had them both pretty close. It didn't turn out to be that way. Norm was 100% right on that one. He saw what Bruce could become, not what he was at the college level at the time, which was a 300-pound guy who was overweight and who flashed incredible talent but didn't produce all the time, versus Ray Childress, who was much lighter and had a motor that would never quit but didn't have the upside that Bruce did. So we had to get that out of the way. And then we had to get Bruce signed. And in competition with the Baltimore Stars of the USFL. Bruce is from Virginia Beach, Virginia. Baltimore was much closer to home than Buffalo. And Buffalo at that time, with all due respect to all my friends in Buffalo, it was viewed as Siberia. Jokes on TV by Johnny Carson. You know, we were the laughing stock in the National Football League in the city, and Western New York was the laughing stock, really, of America at that point, for a lot of different reasons. Buffalo had hemorrhaged over 200,000 jobs when the steel industry went down in the 70s and early 80s. So it was a shell of what it had been economically, and unfortunately, the Bills' performance reflected that. In any event, there was a supplemental draft at that time where the rules were very different than they are now. And the principal rule was that a player, if he completed his college education, could, before the supplemental draft, could declare for the supplemental draft and be eligible. So that's what Bernie Kosar decided to do, because he wanted to play for his hometown team, the Cleveland Browns. As I remember, Bernie's from Akron, or the Akron area. And Ernie Accorsi was then the general manager of the Cleveland Browns. And so Ernie called asking if we would trade the first pick in the supplemental draft, which belonged to us by way of the 2-14 season. Pardon me. And so we discussed it, Kay and Norm and I. Terry Bledsoe, our general manager, was out of the picture because he had suffered a debilitating heart attack, which kept him bedridden and unable to work for almost 6 months. So we discussed the issue of the trade, and we asked for, as I recall, a first, a second, and a third to do it. So we were going to swap with Cleveland, so we had an extra first-round pick. And then we got a second, third, maybe even a fourth to do it. But Cleveland was offering, in lieu of the lower draft choices, was offering players, the most notable of which was Chip Banks, a linebacker who was going to hold out. He wasn't going to come in with Cleveland, although he had, I think, a year, maybe two to go on his contract. And he was a good linebacker. And so we're debating whether or not to make the trade, number one, and number two, whether or not to go ahead and get Chip Banks in lieu of, this, I think, the third and fourth round choices, or second, third choices. I was out scouting somewhere, you know, in the pre-draft period, and ran into a friend of mine who had worked for the Browns. And, of course, you know, you can't keep talks like that quiet because agents are involved and stuff like that. And he said to me, "You're going to make that trade?" And I said, "Well, we're debating it. I think so." Norm is kind of leaning that way. Kay's kind of leaning that way. And he said, "Let me tell you something. Chip Banks is never coming to Buffalo. Never." So I said, "Oh, okay." So I took the, as a good scout, it was my job to bring the intelligence information back. So I brought it back. I gave Kay and Norm the source, which they recognized was a good source. And so Kay said, all right, let's do this. He said, you call Ernie and tell him that we want to talk with Chip Banks before we make the trade. So I called Ernie, and he readily agreed. Ernie's a great guy, by the way.
Great guy.
And so Chip Banks, as I recall, was living in Atlanta. And so Elijah Pitts went down to talk with him, our offensive backfield coach. And Elijah was one of the world's great guys and had played with for Lombardi in Green Bay along with Jim Ringo. You know, and everybody loved Elijah, God rest his soul. So he goes down there and he goes to Chip Banks' apartment. He lived in an apartment house down there, and or a townhome, I guess. Knocks on the door and says, Chip comes to the door but doesn't open it and says, you know, who is it? Elijah Pitts from the Buffalo Bills. Chip never opened the door. They had a conversation through the door. And so Elijah came back and said, Chip Banks is not coming to Buffalo. So we turned that part of the trade down and got the draft choices instead. And I know there was a fourth involved. I'm certain there was, because that fourth became Andre Reed and the third became Frank Reich. In any event, that was the sort of backstory involving Ernie and of course, and the Browns. And of course, Bernie went to Cleveland and had a great career with the Browns and is still a beloved Brown to this day.
Yep. Absolutely. Took them about as close as they were ever going to get, it seems, you know, to the big game. So, Bill, I don't know if you know this or not. Getting back to the Bruce Smith thing, you know, as you'll recall, Brig Owens was Bruce's primary agent. And Brig and I were quite good friends, and we were colleagues when I was at the NFL Players Association. And he had never done a big contract before. I know you hadn't either, but neither had he. So he had called me prior to beginning and you know, asked me what he thought, what I thought was a reasonable number, and did some role playing and told him what to expect in the negotiation. So I'm wondering how accurate my speculation was way back all those years ago about how high you were willing to go. You know, so take us through that negotiation from your point of view. You know, and then the you had the major takeaways from the experience of doing your first big contract. Tell us how you grew as a result of that. But let me know how close I was to knowing we could, how far we could push you.
Well, again, that was a that year 84 and 85 was an untoward year. Nothing like 2020, but a lot of crazy stuff happening. And so Terry Bledsoe became ill and had this terrible heart attack. So he's bedridden. And we've got to sign Bruce Smith. So Mr. Wilson called Kay Stevenson and Norm Pollum and a man named Pat McGroder, who is Pat was close to 80 at that point in time, but had been Ralph's guy in Buffalo for a long time. Pat was a lifelong Buffalonian. And all three of those guys had taken a liking to me. And so they told Ralph, listen, we have Bill Polian here. He's the pro guy. He signed players in Canada. He signed players in the USFL. He can do this negotiation. He can handle it. And so Mr. Wilson said, okay, send him over here. So I went over to Detroit to meet with him, and I met with Dave Olson, who was the treasurer for Ralph's businesses. He had a number of businesses over and above the Bills. And We talked about the substance of the contract. We talked about guarantees. We talked about the way it should be handled. We talked about what the money ought to be. And so Mr. Wilson said, well, you know, I've always believed that smart young people deserve a chance, so I'm going to give you a chance. You go ahead and do it. Dave will work with the cash flow and things like that. You two guys go ahead and do it. So off we went. And
no pressure.
Yeah. Well, it's a chance to move out of the broom closet. That's the best part of it.
Yeah, those speeches they always produce just a smidge of pressure when it's like, I always think young people deserve a shot.
Keep in mind that I was still in the broom closet. I hadn't changed offices.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, this is your chance.
So
escape from the broom closet.
So we went into the negotiations. As it turned out, Brig and I had known each other from the USFL days. And I always had high regard for him. I was friendly with George Allen. He had played for George Allen. So we had common ground, which is really important when you're doing a negotiation of any kind. If you have common ground, it's a lot easier than to just have to go in and do it cold.
Yep. Yep. And Bruce he was also a great guy, Bill. I mean, Brig was your kind of guy. I mean, solid, honest, honorable.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. All of the above. And so, and Dave was just as good as you would find in terms of both numbers. He was a phenomenal finance person and one of the really great people you'll ever meet in your life. And as a bishop in the Mormon faith, you know, that really says it all. So it looked like we're getting along pretty well. Now the Smith family had an attorney who was working alongside Brig, and really, unless it got into arcane financial issues, Dave Olson really didn't do much talking. I did most of the talking, and a lot of it was on football and cultural issues with Buffalo. Bruce had some real feelings, as did everyone at that point, about not wanting to go to Buffalo. In the view of the football world, Buffalo was Siberia, and so there was a lot of discussion of that. That was the first negotiation. And then the second, third, fourth, fifth, it went on for the better part of about 3 weeks, as I recall, ended up being about money. And as we went along, particularly after we got past the early football and cultural issues, the attorney for the Smith family would keep bringing up the Buffalo cultural issues and how bad the team was and things of that nature. It was pretty clear, at least to me, that he was working on the star's side of the street, because he would always make comparisons. Oh, Coach Moore is this and Carl Peterson is that, and we don't even know you, and Stevenson's not a good coach, and you know, things of that nature. Now, whether that was designed to get under my skin or was actually designed to influence the talks, I don't know, but that's sort of the tenor of it. So then in the final analysis, Dave and I said, look, we've got to bring this to a head one way or the other. And don't forget, because of the rules, we had not exercised the choice yet. We hadn't chosen Bruce. We weren't going to actually choose him. This was going on in February and March. We were going to actually choose him once we had agreement on the contract. So the whole card we had was, if you're not going to sign with us, we're not going to choose you. So that's, you know, be our guest. Go where you want. So it finally came down to that. I didn't put it as crassly as that. I was polite and said, look, Mr. Wilson's done all he can. We've done all we can. And if you're going to sign with us, we'll welcome you with open arms. And we think that, you know, what we've talked about here is appropriate. And if you don't wish to, then go ahead to Baltimore, be our guest, and we'll move on. And so, as I recall, Briggs said, "Okay, we'll be back to you in a day." So they, as good as a word, he got back, and we did some little gives at the end of the contract. You always hold something back because the agent always wants something at the end to close the deal. So we did that, and so he can tell his client he got a little bit more at the end. Honestly, I can't remember what the number was, but I know that our ceiling was somewhere around $1 million. And I don't think we got there. I think we got it done under that. Something around $750,000 rings a bell in my mind, but I don't remember, and I don't have any notes on it. So
okay.
I don't know what your number was, Rick, but
well, yeah. I mean, at that point, actually, you just mentioned my number. I kind of figured with the, you know, and also, Bill, you in terms of the litany of problems in bringing to Buffalo and Johnny Carson, you left out one other element, snow.
Oh, well, that's a given. That's a given.
which did not present. We'll find a way to get you to practice every day when you have to dig out, you know, from your house at a 5 feet of snow.
That's a given.
Yeah, but $750K in Buffalo in 1985 is like $1 trillion. There also has to be another way to spend that.
I actually remember a Johnny Carson joke. He said, "The mayor of Buffalo has come up with a new snow removal system. It's called spring."
Which in a good year comes on May 1st.
Yeah,
that's right. But a million was what I said to Brig. And I remember when we went back and forth and he told me, you know, and actually he was quite laudatory about you. And he felt that, you know, you had gone as far as you could possibly go. And, and this is a big deal in his career. You know, his first big name contract for a player. So, but I felt like at the end, everybody actually did walk away feeling fairly treated on both sides. So I think that's the key to a good contract, because, you know, the next guy's going to come in the next year, and numbers are always going to change, and players are always going to be in a way dissatisfied with what they get when they see what the guy behind them's getting. So the only thing you can hope for is you develop a good relationship in the time. You feel you're being fairly treated at the time of the negotiation. And then you know that a guy like Bill Polian, if you succeed, is going to take care of you down the road. There'll be other chances. So that's, you know, and I think, Bill, that was what you did and do. So I think that's really, to me, the way to maintain the relationship with a guy who goes on to be a superstar like Bruce.
Yeah, and I know it was less than $1 million. It could have been 900 for all I know. Once this podcast is up, Bruce will call me and let me know how wrong I was on the number. But if I'm wrong, but I think it was somewhere between 750 and 850, something like that. Anyway, because the number 1 million is actually what Jim got on an annual basis, Jim Kelly. So
yeah,
Bruce wasn't going to get that much, but it was a record contract at the time. No question about that. So, we went ahead and Bruce came in and signed, and we had a great draft that year. As I said, drafted Frank Reich and Andre Reed. And, so the cornerstone for the resurgence of the Bills was laid. And interestingly enough, before we entered into the Ernie Accorsi Cleveland Brown trade, I met with Coach Stevenson, and who I to this day revere. I mean, he's one of just a phenomenal person and a really good coach. And I said to him, "Look, you know, we got the first pick in the draft, and it's a good draft. And we've got We can get to all these picks in the supplemental draft. And if we want to trade them, we can get a king's ransom in terms of veteran players back. And let's face it, if we don't win next year, we're all out. And most of all, you're out. So my strong opinion is let's see what kind of players we can get in trade for these picks. And let's start winning football games. We had Joe Ferguson at quarterback, and he was coming toward the end of his career, but I thought he was still serviceable, and so did Kay. We'd lost Joe Cribbs to the USFL, which was a tremendous blow, and we needed a running back. Greg Bell was supposed to be that guy, but hadn't really panned out, and so that was a viable alternative. And Kay looked me right in the eye and said, "No, Bill, our job here is to build the best franchise we can. And drafting Bruce Smith and other good players is how we build this franchise. That's our responsibility. And if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out for us. But we've done the best we can for Mr. Wilson and the franchise." I've never forgotten that. And he paid the price. Kay paid the price, and he did more than selflessly, more than anybody, to start the resurgence of the Buffalo Bills, because the cornerstone for all the success we had later on was due to his selflessness.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, Bill, one sort of nerdy before we kind of wrap the 85 draft, because I've always wanted to ask this. So, you know, obviously the 85 draft was amazing. There's five Hall of Famers. You guys drafted two of them in Andre Reed and Bruce Smith. One thing that I've always thought was interesting was you needed a receiver, and receiver was a position of that you wanted to address. When you had that, because a lot of people maybe forget this, as part of that sort of Cleveland Browns smorgasbord trade, you ended up with 14 as well. And then two picks later, Jerry Rice would be selected by the 49ers. Was he in the obviously you were pro personnel at the time. Was he in the conversation for Terry Bledsoe at that point? Did he come up at all at 14?
Not that I recall. Not that I recall.
Could you have imagined that K-Gun offense with Jerry Rice and Andre Reed? I mean,
The rap on Jerry, I thought in my mind, I'd have to go look this up, but in my mind, I think Jerry came out the following year. Was he in that 85 draft?
Yeah. He was drafted 16th in that 85 draft. So I've always thought, you know, knowing you now, it's like that feels like that would have been a Bill 3 out of 5 Hall of Famer kind of pull. And oh, by the way, you got Kevin Green in Carolina.
The knock on Jerry was that he didn't run fast. Which he really didn't, but yeah. That didn't mean anything when he got on the football field.
Right, right. Did the level of competition also hurt him from college?
Yeah, it was a consideration. Yeah, it was a consideration.
I mean, I always think that, you know, that in that kind of a situation, you know, the guy can't run fast, and if you're comparing him to talent at a lower level, you know, you think, oh yeah, but when he moves up, he's not going to be able to do whatever he's doing. So if, you know, cause if he had been playing at the top level and you saw the passes he was catching, who cares how fast he is? But you know, I think that to me, that was a double problem, for him. And you know, look, he only turned out to be the greatest receiver in the history of football. So 85, let's talk about 85. Good news was you had Bruce Smith, who was a star player, takes a little of the sting out of losing Joe Cribbs to the USFL. But at the season's end, the record book would again reflect a 2-14 season. In your mind, at that point, let's take you back to that point, where did things stand with the club, and where did things stand with Bill Polian and the club?
Well, Kay had been let go at midseason. And was replaced by Hank Bulla, who was the defensive coordinator.
Very different kind of guy.
Totally different, yeah. Hank had brought in Jim Valick, who was an acquaintance of his, I don't know if they'd worked together somewhere before, to essentially be his general manager. Jim Valek was running all of football operations. Terry Bledsoe was back at work, but Valek had essentially come in and said, I'm in charge, and nobody had said otherwise. And so I was reporting to Jim Valek, and that was, you know, it wasn't a good relationship. I mean, he was professional enough and nice enough, but I don't think he placed any value on my work. So it was one of those situations where you say to yourself, well, hey, once this season ends and I'm gone. So like most other people in that situation, like many of the holdover coaches from K's staff, I just, you know, began to say, well, it's over for me. And then I went off to scout the All-Star games, which I, you know, is part of my duty. I did a lot of college work where Norm Pollum was the boss, and I learned a great deal from him. And I was at, as I recall, it might have been the Blue-Gray All-Star game, which is Christmas week. I don't think it was the Senior Bowl, but it was the last week of the regular season, and I was not at our game. I wasn't at most of the games because I was the advanced guy, but I wasn't advancing that week, so I went off to the All-Star game, interviewing players and things like that, and obviously scouting the practices. And so I called back to the office on Monday morning. We got our clock cleaned by somebody on Sunday afternoon, and I called back to Terry Bledsoe, to whom I was ostensibly still reporting, and I said to him, well, Terry, the best thing about this season is it's over. And and he said, yeah, well, I got news for you. I said, what's that? He said, I've been fired. So, whoa. So I was shocked. And I you know, I committed a terrible faux pas by, you know, making that statement. I apologized. And he said, well, everything will be okay. You know, don't worry about it. He said, you got a good reputation. Everybody here respects you. He said, had I stayed, I was going to name you assistant general manager anyway. So, you know, you'll be okay. And I'll be happy to give you good reference. So I thanked him very much and hung up the phone. And a couple of nights earlier at this All-Star game, I'd run into Jim Schaaf, who had been my boss in Kansas City, and who is really the guy who got me started on the executive track. I would have been very happy to be a scout for the rest of my life. But Jim got me started on the executive track, and we talked, and he said, how's things going? I said, I think we're done, Jim. It's, you know, you can, we all have a sense of it in this business when it's over. And he said, well, what would you think about coming back and working for me? And I said, wow, yeah, that'd be great. So he said, okay, depending on what happens at the end of the season, let's talk. So I said, okay, tremendous. So I called home and I said, you know, Jim Schaaf said, there's a chance we go back to the Chiefs. And everybody felt a little bit better. And, you know, you always try to prepare your family for when things like that are going to happen. And it's this business is harder on the families than it is on anyone else. We get inured to it, but the families don't. And so I was planning on hopefully going back to the Kansas City Chiefs. And then out of the blue, I got a call from Dave Olson, who said, listen, can you come up to Detroit tomorrow? And I said, yeah, sure. Okay. And I didn't ask why. I presumed it was maybe because Mr. Wilson wanted to say goodbye, or maybe on the off chance, tell me, look, we're going to keep you in the position you're in until we name a new general manager or something along those lines. So I flew up to Detroit and went over to the office, and Mr. Wilson said, we're going to name you the new general manager. And literally, he could have knocked me over with a feather. I was shocked. I think this was New Year's Eve, if I'm not mistaken. And I was just shocked. I was speechless. So I said, okay, thank you. And he said, here's what we're going to pay you. And he gave me a figure. And I immediately said yes. And I immediately became the lowest paid general manager in the league.
I want to say, for the record, I was not representing Bill at that time.
Obviously, I got home. I was shocked. Everybody in the family was shocked. Lots of people were, you know, the family was overjoyed because they were going to get to stay in Buffalo, which we had come to love. And I thought, well, you know, we've got a chance here to do this right. Kay's not here, but we've got a chance to do this right. And we got to get the organization focused on football and not on the past and not on who did what to whom, but get on with the job of winning, which the organization had lost its way. There was no two ways about that. The irony of the whole thing is that a couple of weeks previous, I had in a hotel room somewhere, because I was on the road from Thursday till Sunday night in those days, I'd sat down and written on a yellow sheet of paper a letter to Dave Olson, which essentially said, even though this looks terribly bad, it is soluble for the following reasons, but it's going to take a lot of hard work, a lot of effort, and a lot of focus that is not there now. But it's not nearly as bad as people portray it. Now, whether that had something to do with my getting the job or not, I don't know. It was just my way of thanking Dave, you know, for having the ability to work with him, and secondly, to just tell him how I felt about the future of the franchise. In any event, we had the press conference. I introduced myself as Bill Who, which was appropriate because there wasn't a soul outside of the people in the office and a few of the friends that I'd made in Buffalo that knew that I even worked for the Bills. And then came up from the press conference, and actually, obviously, that's a happy day when you get a job. And the first person that came in the office was the ticket manager. Keep in mind, we had an 80,000-seat stadium at the time. Ticket manager came in, and he said, well, you've just gotten all the good news of being general manager. The bad news is that we have 12,000 season tickets for next year. Okay. Thank you.
That would work well this year, 12,000 and 80,000 seat stadium, but not then.
Not then. And the next call I got was from Jim Finks, who is then the president of the New Orleans Saints, and as we've mentioned on previous podcasts, had been a friend and a mentor. And my assistant said, Mr. Finks is on the line. And I said, oh, great, thank you. So I picked up the phone. I said, how you doing? And he said, congratulations, you're one day closer to being fired. So, an auspicious beginning, to say the least. Yeah.
But, hey, it's a perfect segue, because into next week's episode, we'll figure out how you were charged with filling some of those seats with the eventual signing and bringing of Jim Kelly to Buffalo. So without any further ado, Rick, I think we're on to the audible, and you have this week's first one, and it's a fan question.
Yeah, this is a fan question. Bill and I have talked about this during the past couple of weeks. So, Bill, bear with me. I think it's a reasonable question from a fan. I know some of what you're going to say, but please be gentle with both of us. Okay, he says, dear Bill Polian, with what feels like a massive amount of injuries to starters and season-ending ones at that, are we on the threshold that says preseason, OTAs, and so on are necessary? I know that you talked about it in the latest audible. If not, when?
Well, yes, I think we're finding out that some form of preseason is necessary. Is it three games? I think most football people would like that. Is it two games? I think the league office and some owners would like that. It's going to fall somewhere in that vicinity. You're going to need, let's assume it's two games. You're going to need a couple or maybe three scrimmages, joint practices against other teams to get your team ready. You can't have a truncated training camp the way we did now. Although the rules that apply to training camp since the 11 collective bargaining agreement are fine. I don't have any problem with that, and I don't think many coaches do. OTAs are another matter, and I think that we ought to take a look at that in terms of extending the strength and conditioning program. Bill Parcells has, and many other knowledgeable strength and conditioning people, have contended for years that we need 6 weeks of strength and conditioning. And I agree with that completely before they ever hit the field. So let's get our 6 weeks in. If that leaves us six or eight or nine OTA practices, that's okay. We'll be fine with that so long as we get the strength and conditioning part of it built up. That's what we're seeing, I think, contributing to some degree to the injuries at this point in time. Now, this is way too early to make judgments on injuries. We need to wait until the end of the season,
yeah,
till we get the statistics, and then the competition committee will talk about it. But our questioner is exactly right. It's the right question to ask, because strength and conditioning, OTAs, and the preseason and injuries go hand in hand.
So to drill down just a little bit deeper on that, though, distinguish for our question asker, who is terrific, the difference, you think, between soft tissue injuries and real orthopedic injuries relative to practice and so on.
Well, trauma injuries, broken legs, broken arms, broken collarbones, broken wrists, are unfortunately part and parcel of the game. Whether knee injuries, ligament injuries, can be somehow affected by strength and conditioning braces at all is a question that is asked forever, and no one seems to have a definitive answer for it. We do know that shoes that are not compatible with artificial turf do contribute to high ankle sprains. But that's the only scientific evidence that I've come across that deals with that. So trauma injuries are always going to be with us. The question of soft tissue injuries, ligaments, muscle strains, pulled muscles, ankle sprains, things of that nature are directly related to strength, conditioning, and hydration and fatigue. So those things we can deal with. We can make a dent in. And I've always said that if I were to go back as a team president or general manager, which obviously I'm not, but if I were, the first thing I would do would be bring my analytics people in and say to them, I want you to get with the top biomechanics people in the country, and I want an in-depth study on the last 3 years of our injuries. You tell me why they happened, how they happened, under what conditions, and what conclusions you can draw from that. We're missing the boat. Now, I know the league is doing that on a league-wide basis. I don't know the clubs are. But if they're not, you're missing the boat on that. There's so much that analytics can help us learn in conjunction with doctors, trainers, biomechanists that can make us better.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very cool. All right. Well, with mine, I'm going to take us into a little different direction. So we're going to, in the coming weeks, we're going to have a special episode where we kind of look at the first several weeks of the season in review and kind of give you guys some insights on what we're seeing from the season. But so what we want to do in my audible today is, Bill, kind of get you to give us some takes on any insights or any things that you saw from this week in the league. I could not help myself as I sort of now knowing you have sort of by default become a Bills fan in the Bills game yesterday with all the K-Gun talk in the Bills Raiders broadcast. What were your sort of key takeaways from this past week in the league? And do these Bills remind you at all of sort of some of your early Super Bowl teams that you had in Buffalo?
Well, it's hard to make those comparisons without a full season's worth of work. But I'll give you sort of the top line takeaways that I've seen thus far. In the Bills' case, little concerned about the pass rush. It got going in the fourth quarter, so that was a good sign, but it was missing until then. So are there enough pass rushers? A lot of this is affected on a week-to-week basis by injuries, too, and I recognize that. But that's just a question that I came away with. Secondly, Josh Allen is playing lights out, but he needs to have a light on in his game management head all the time, because the play that he made at the end of the game, which resulted in an interception, is inexcusable and unforgivable, because he had a field goal that would have put the game out of reach in his pocket. There was no reason to make that play. He just got excited and tried to make a play. But you can't win championships doing those things, because had he done that against the old Tom Brady New England Patriots, guess what? They would have cashed it in.
Bye-bye.
So you can't give people gifts.
Bill, is that the kind of thing that going into a situation like that, knowing what was going to be at stake on, say, third down, that a coach would say to a young quarterback, Josh, if it's not there, don't try? Or is that, at this point in his career, something you would just expect him to know on his own?
Well, I don't know if Sean told him that or not. I can't remember if there was a timeout prior to the play, but there's certainly – he'll hear it from his coach and his coordinator and his position coach today, that's for sure. And he'll learn a lesson from it. He'll remember it. Peyton Manning made a similar mistake in a playoff game one time, trying to go for a touchdown and you know, instead of ensuring a chip shot field goal to tie the game by running the ball and then going for the touchdown to win it, and we ended up losing the game because the 41-yard field goal was missed. So, you know, you learn from experience, but it's not a criticism. Like I said, he's playing lights out, but quarterbacking is not just about that physical playing at the position. It's also managing the game. So that's not a concern, but it certainly the coaches will correct it today. In terms of the Ravens, there is a way to defense Lamar. You have to know how to do it. Kansas City did. Washington did not. You treat him as a runner first, last, and always. You spill everything, and you make him make the hard throws, and you don't put him in a position where he can get free runners down the middle of the field, which is where he likes to throw the ball. So Washington didn't do that and ended up paying a price for it.
We tried hard. I thought we looked okay yesterday. I thought we gave it a good college try. I thought we were going to lose by 500 points. So the fact that we were kind of quasi in the game going into half, I felt pretty good.
So what do you want to do? Give them participation trophies, Scott?
I think that's what we're doing this season. Hard. I honestly think we're trying hard.
Come on.
Coach Rivera is building a culture. I'm very concerned about Dwayne. Being totally honest, I don't think I'm very worried about Dwayne.
Well, you got time for that to deal with that.
But is it a bad sign that we already have these leaks that we're maybe making a change at quarterback? Something's got to be wrong because Coach Rivera is not that kind of guy. So they must be seeing something they don't like.
Yeah, I'm sure they are. When you don't win, you're seeing things you don't like.
It's the score at the end of the game.
I wouldn't put a lot of stock in it. You know, Ron's a guy that'll tell you right up front. The big storyline last week was Drew Brees is finished. He's lost it. His arm is gone, et cetera, et cetera. Hello, 35 points against the Lions.
Yeah, yep.
That was a get right.
You don't get an award for that, but Drew is not done. And when Michael Thomas comes back, he'll be back to his old self. The Jaguars have no defense. They've got Chark and the running back on offense. A couple of good offensive linemen. Defensively, not much there. Got a chance to see the Panthers against the Cardinals yesterday. Teddy Bridgewater was Teddy Bridgewater, flawless. Not a rocket arm by any means, not Josh Allen, but he can make a lot of throws. He's as courageous as can be. He's a charismatic leader. You know, absent some phenom in the draft, I'm not so sure they don't think they got their quarterback there. The other thing is that Coach Rhule can coach. And by the way, Phil Snow, their defensive coordinator, had a great game plan for Kyler Murray. I know Kyler Murray is putting up big fantasy numbers, and that's fine. I don't deal with fantasy. He is a really good thrower. He can throw the football with the best of them. The rest of it is a work in progress. So I'm not putting him in the Pro Bowl or any of that stuff right now. I mean, he's not there yet. But when you've got the kind of ability to throw the ball that he has, there's a lot to work with there. But they have to craft an offense around him that is a pro offense, but takes into consideration his ability to make plays outside the pocket. But if you keep him in the pocket, he's 5'10", and he plays like it, which is not a knock. But, you know, as Bill Parcells says, there's a way to win every game. You got to find it. The Carolina Panthers did. And by the way, they're playing hard as can be, which is the first indices of how good a coach is. They're playing hard. Seahawks, Russell Wilson is playing as well as any quarterback has played maybe in a long time in the National Football League. But I worry greatly about their offensive line and about their but more importantly, their defense. Russell covers up a multitude of sins on the offensive line, and they built their team accordingly. And there's no reason to criticize that. But defensively, because of injury and other things, I worry that they can make it all the way with that kind of defense. Having said that, Russell is having an out-of-this-world year, and sometimes, especially in this period of time, it can take you a long way. Houston is 0-4. They're better than that. The offense is adjusting to the loss of the great receiver. But defensively, I worry about them too. I don't know that they have enough. They're not going to finish 2-14. I don't think the quarterback is better than that. Their offensive line is better than that. Their receiving core will meld and become better than that. But defensively, they're not. It doesn't look like a championship team.
The schedule makers didn't do them any favors either, though.
No, but I don't take that into consideration. You judge the team on how they play, not necessarily who they play. And I don't like what I'm seeing defensively from them. Now, there's an old saying in this league, having said all of this, good teams get better, bad teams don't. And over the next 4 weeks, we will see the good teams begin to surge and the bad teams begin to sink. So 4 weeks from now, we'll have a really good feel for who's good and who's not good. Lastly, for those of you in Philadelphia who are ready to jump off the Ben Franklin Bridge and take Carson Wentz with you, hold on, please. Carson Wentz is still Carson Wentz. He's playing with pickup guys off the street at receiver. He's playing with an offensive line that is aged to begin with and now is injured. And he's doing amazing and interesting things. He's not perfect, and he can't be because he's under constant pressure and doesn't have any sync with any of the receivers. It's amazing that he did what he did last night against a pretty good 49er defense. Both teams were beaten to a pulp. They had that was an example of an NFL JV game with a lot of the stars in it, the varsity stars in it. And so it made it a great football game.
That Nick Mullins interception was one of the craziest throws I have ever seen in my entire life.
Yeah.
Late in that game.
Yeah, yeah. But Carson Wentz is still Carson Wentz, and you take him every day and twice on Sunday.
Yep.
All right. Well, that's it for this week. As you heard from Bill, Philadelphia, stay calm, but be nervous because I think 6 wins might win the division this year, and that football team in Washington is coming. Well, if you have any questions or anything you'd like us to cover in the audible or topics you want us to hit, feel free to hit us at IFBillPaulian on Twitter, and get ready. Next week is a show that's going to be a real fun one as we get into bringing Jim Kelly to Buffalo. Thank you, guys. And enjoy week 5.
Well, Jim Kelly's getting there. Hallelujah. Let me say that. And it's been fun today. Look forward to talking to you next week, everybody. Stay safe. Stay well. We'll talk to you soon.
Stay safe, everyone.